Broadcasting to New York City, Los Angeles, Chicago, Sydney, London, and around the world, this is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live on 101.3 KPCG. Coming up on this Thursday edition, tragedy at a state fair in Ohio. Really a deadly situation from one of the rides there. Also, a U.S. State Department warning about traveling to Mexico. It's getting more dangerous. Maybe you've heard of the fitness fad, HIIT, high-intensity interval training. Some people are saying that's not such a good idea. And the struggle isn't over in the Middle East. Not surprising, but that's what they say. That and more coming up this edition of Trumpet Radio Live.
This is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live. We're at 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Appreciate you joining us in those locations. Also, thetrumpet.com has a live link. If you'd like to follow us on Twitter, you can do that at kpcgfm. Any emails you'd like to send, go ahead and send those to comments at kpcg.fm. We appreciate getting those in. Dwight Falk, Grant Turgeon, Abraham Blondo here today. Abraham, you went and saw Dunkirk last night.
I did.
Siskel and Abraham, what's your review?
Well, I think overall it's a very good war movie. I was surprised. I didn't like it as much as I thought I would, but still, it was a very good movie. I think its strength is that it shows you the personal struggle with war, the decisions that have to be made, decisions to sacrifice or to be selfish, and it shows you the struggle, internal struggle each man faces. There isn't a whole lot of dialogue. Most of it's just, it's taken through body language and what's not said. But I think if you want to understand the movie better, you do have to research more into what happened at Dunkirk to get the perspective and a sense of the scale and everything, because it shows you little snapshots of what happened. And to put it in the context, you do have to do some of your own research.
So you're giving it 1.5 thumbs up. Can't quite give it the 2 thumbs.
Yeah, it's almost at 2. It's like my thumb's cramping and it won't go up all the way.
You want to, but you can't quite get there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, sometimes when you're really anticipating a movie and you've heard a lot of good things about it, sometimes it doesn't live up to your expectations. Some of the most, I guess, enjoyable movies I've seen are ones that I didn't know a lot about, and I just, what is this? And then it turned out, wow, that's actually pretty interesting. But when it comes to a movie depicting a historical event, probably you'd be better off to know more about the event going into it, just because you can appreciate it better if it's done pretty well. So obviously there's some things they didn't focus on in the movie, as we've talked about, but hey, at least it's about a historical event, something that did occur, and you know, maybe they're at least taking a stab at it on some level. So that's out in the theaters now. Here's a story from Ohio. This is a terrible deal. Every time, you know, you go to a state fair or an amusement park, you assume the rides will be safe, even though there are thrill rides, but sometimes they have accidents. Fox News says Kasich orders rides shut down after a deadly Ohio State Fair accident. Ohio Governor John Kasich ordered all rides at the State Fair in Columbus to be shut down until thorough inspections are completed. After a ride malfunction Wednesday left one man dead and at least 7 people injured, 2 of the 7 injured were in critical condition. One of the witnesses said, "It was going for a minute, and it was at its highest point, and I saw somebody fall on the ride. And then a minute later, the whole row of seats fell off and hit the ground." If you can imagine that. "Everybody was running," they say. "I got ran over trying to get out of the way." The man who was killed was one of several thrown from the Fireball ride when it malfunctioned, and the victims range in age from 13 to 41. Crews shut down all the other rides. So you go to the fair to have a good time, and a lot of times go with the family and so forth, and all of a sudden a guy falls off. There's video out there of it, which is not recommending necessarily, but it can happen, and it did here in Ohio.
That can be a problem at the fair sometimes. A lot of those rides are very old. They've been around for decades in a lot of cases. They get taken down and then set back up every year a lot of the time. And so you never know if after one of those many deconstructions, if it has been reconstructed the right way. I don't know everything about this situation, but just from being at the Oklahoma State Fair a few times, I can understand why there might be some risks.
It's a good point when they do put things together. And again, I don't know if they were moving this around a lot or how this all worked, but yeah, I mean, you know how it is. You put something together, whether the bookshelf in your house, it's easy to make a mistake, but you have people's lives on the line here. So really tragic event there in Ohio. Yeah, such a strange thing because you're there to have a good time and then it becomes the worst time. So I don't know what will happen. I mean, I don't know if someone's liable or, you know, if the whole row of seats falls off of a ride, it seems like somebody may be. There was another story the other day or so. Some up-and-coming country singer, a lady, she died at a state fair. Can't remember which one, but they were giving her a ride, I think, on a just like an ATV or something, and accident, she died. So, anyway, it's that time of year. It's state fair year, but having a few instances here of some problems.
Yeah, a few times I've been to a state fair in the states here. I don't go on the rides, mainly because the lines are so long. I don't feel like waiting. But also, I'm like, I'm just going to take it easy. I'm not a big fan of theme parks anyway. To me, at least at the Oklahoma State Fair, the most deadly thing I saw were those huge turkey drumsticks.
Oh, yeah.
I saw people eating carrion. I just couldn't believe that they actually sell those. They're like the size of your head.
Like barbarians.
Yeah, and they're just ripping
things.
The flesh off the bone. And I'm sure they taste good, but to me, that was the biggest threat.
Fair.
Yeah.
Fairs are fair food is not... It's not concerned about your health, that's for sure. Yeah, that's true. I think I've been okay at fairs and I've been okay at amusement parks. However, things that spin I don't care for. We went to Six Flags years ago, did all the roller coasters, totally fine, and then decided for some crazy reason to take a ride on the teacups because no one was in line for it. So we're like, let's ride the teacups. Felt sick the rest of the day.
That doesn't go so well with the huge turkey leg and the funnel cake and the 7-layer nachos.
No, well, that's the thing. You're eating that food and then potentially, and then those rides, it's a recipe for disaster. So anyway, but it is, it's always a fan favorite to get out to those fairs and so forth. The State Department has a warning here. They're cautioning U.S. tourists in Mexico about tainted alcohol. Maybe you've heard about some of these situations. The U.S. State Department is cautioning Americans visiting Mexico to be conscious of allegations that consumption of tainted or substandard alcohol has resulted in illness or blacking out. Well, how much did they drink? That's a good question, too. The new advisory posted Wednesday on the U.S. Department of State's Bureau of Consular Affairs, the website for Mexico, comes after reports of alcohol-related horror stories involving tourists visiting the country have mounted. There have been a few in the news lately where people said they drank something and all of a sudden they were unconscious or they had other problems. And they were surprised by it because it was one drink or something to where it wouldn't normally affect you that way. So I don't know. I mean, Mexico's got some places that people do like to vacation at. Wouldn't be the top of my list, I guess. It probably depends. Some places might be great, others not so great. But here's a warning: if you go down there, to be careful what you drink.
I remember my sister did go to Mexico 1 year back when it was a little safer, I mean it is really nice. I was reading a biography of Ulysses Grant, and they were in Mexico during the war, so they weren't there on vacation. But they did remark how beautiful it was. The climate's almost perfect in some places. And through summer and winter, it's perfect all year round. You don't sweat, you don't get sunburn, and you don't get cold. So there are some really, really nice places there for scenery and climate. But unfortunately, it's the I guess the violence and the bad parts of society that kind of bring down some things that really could make Mexico popular or bring in some income.
Yeah, and a lot of that actually, you got to point the finger back at the U.S. because of the drug trade. And the violence down there because of that, and it comes up to the U.S. and it's down there too. So
it's actually surprising. Ulysses S. Grant also remarked at how the upper class in Mexico was basically brutalizing the lower class everywhere they looked during that war with Mexico. That was like 1840s or something, but it's sort of relevant today because you see the cartels brutalizing people now. They have all the money, and they're the ones who are abusing the lower class.
Yeah, that's true. That's a good point. Here's a headline from CNN. I didn't take a lot of the story because of just a lot of political back and forth, but the headline I think is interesting. It's a sign of the times. Obviously, yesterday, President Trump, I think it was yesterday, tweeted that no transgenders coming into the military anymore would be allowed in the military. So the backlash, of course. CNN.com's headline is, Democrats say they're ready for a culture war as Trump bans transgender people from military service. And then they just go on to talk about some politicians and their what they say they're going to do and so on and so forth. A lot of talk right now, but they're talking about a culture war. And it's happening, right? At least as far as back and forth and talking. The problem is, does it escalate? That's the question, I guess.
Well, that's strange because we've been in a culture war for a long time now, ever since, probably at least ever since World War II. So maybe they're just going to fight the culture war even harder. They've already been winning it, and you can see that in entertainment or pretty much every area of society where the morals have declined steeply. I can't even imagine how bad it's going to be if they are just now going to start fighting a culture war in their own minds.
Yeah, maybe they're just going to ratchet it up a notch. I don't know. Part of it is, too, they obviously lost the White House. They've lost, they've lost everything, really. And so they've been trying to retool and say, okay, post-President Obama, what do we do? And so they had come out and said, we're going to get away from the identity politics, and we're going to focus on the economy and so on and so forth. But now they, after yesterday's announcement, I guess they've thrown that out and said, no, forget it. Well, we're still going to do the economy and stuff, but we're going after this culture war. And they're trying to say that you can be an extremely prosperous nation, but you can get into whatever you want to on the cultural side. Historically, that's not true. It's never worked.
Yeah, it is interesting seeing how this is playing out because the military is becoming the next battleground for the culture war. Right when we're in the middle of trying to figure out how to fight these other wars. So it's taking the focus off of what's really important and putting on something that isn't really that important, to be honest. There's only 6,000 transgender people in the military tops. Very low recruitment levels. It's not a huge. It's not impacting the military in a major way. It is the biggest way it's impacting it is on how much money the military spends for their programs and for their medical expenses, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But there aren't a whole lot of transgender people in the military anyway. So, the biggest thing I guess it comes down to is whether they have the same rights or not. But still, I think it's just a big non-issue. In my opinion, when we're trying to win the war in Afghanistan, we're trying to figure out how to defeat ISIS. North Korea has ICBMs, and Hawaii just released a report today that their people need to be prepared for a nuclear attack. I mean, these are the big problems the U.S. military is facing, and this is just a huge sideshow.
Right, and that's a really good point you bring up. Only about 6,000 or so, give or take. And even in the CNN article, the people that are trying to, that are pro-transgender to be in the military, what they're saying is, well, you know, you can't not allow some of the best and the brightest and the most, you know, highly skilled people to not be in there. But numbers-wise, that's not the case. There's not enough of them to even probably factor into that. So that doesn't totally make sense. But then also they said, well, you can't tell somebody that they can't serve their country and be who they are. So, okay, that sounds good. But just even if we just get rid of all the the transgender stuff, everybody has preferences, right? Whether it's like what you like for dinner or, I mean, everyone has certain preferences. But you can't go into some place and demand that everybody follows your preference or else. You can't go into the military and be like, yeah, but I only eat spaghetti for dinner, so. I mean, it's silly, right? But still, to say that you have to be who you are and everyone just has to accept it. But you're pushing your ideals on everybody, and nowhere else in life can you really do that. You can't go to a job that says you have to wear a tie and say, well, you know, I'll tell you, I'm just going to not wear a shirt or a tie. Sorry, that's who I am. I mean, it just doesn't work, or society unravels.
Well, even in the military itself, you have to pass rigorous tests of your physical endurance and your mental toughness. Transgender people, they have lost a mental battle, and that's why they're in the situation they're in. That is not the best type of soldier you'd want to try to recruit to the armed forces.
So there's going to be, I'm sure, back and forth on that, the culture war. Like you said, Grant, it's been going on for a long time, and they've been winning it. But and then, you know, the military is the next frontier, I guess. Abraham, you have a story here. This is I don't know a lot about this. I'll be interested to hear about this. But HBO, which I don't have nor watch, is they have quite a few shows in there, and a lot of them are controversial. This is a write-up. It says, the problem with HBO's Confederate is that the legacy of slavery isn't an alt-history fantasy. It's our reality. So there's a show on. I've seen a few headlines. There's some controversy. Confederate. It's about that time period, Civil War, right?
Yeah.
I'm guessing. And it's about slavery or something. So what's the show about, and what's all the controversy here?
Yeah, so it's a spinoff of Game of Thrones. Basically, the same people who made Game of Thrones made this show.
Oh, they saw the pot of gold.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Make a controversial, counterfactual historical drama. And
watch
basically,
the dough roll in.
Yeah. Basically, the story takes place in an alternate history where the South did secede from the North after a second Civil War. And so the South is its own country. And so the story follows what's going on in the Confederacy at this time. So this would be like the 1870s, 1880s, in that time period. And in the story, I guess, in the Confederate's North, so like Virginia and the Carolinas, I guess, slavery is outlawed. But in the South, Florida and different places and Georgia, it's still alive and well, as they say here. And there's a possibility of a civil war within the Confederacy between the North and the South inside of that. So that's kind of the counterfactual situation there.
Yeah.
And basically, the controversy is over how slavery is depicted and what they're trying to get across by showing this history. I think is interesting. I think basically what they're doing is showing that the Confederacy, or people who have the, who believe in the Confederacy or are proud of the Southern culture, it's no matter what they do, it'll always be embracing slavery. That's kind of one of the big themes that are projected from this. But to me, I mean, these counterfactual shows are interesting, and they do help us think about, well, what if this didn't happen? I mean, I think it does a good job at showing how fractured America can become if we didn't unite at that time period in the 1860s, that we would keep fracturing over and over again until we're like Europe, where we have all these little countries, we can't unite, and we're powerless to really do anything. So I think these types of shows help us remind us of that. And with this, you can take the negative point of view, like I think a lot of people are, and I think it's very unhistorical to think that slavery would still exist in the South, and I can talk about that a little bit later. Just that I think slavery would have evaporated eventually on its own. It would have made itself extinct because it was becoming less and less economically viable in the South the longer it existed. So I think they would have gotten rid of it eventually anyway. But I think one of the biggest things to take away from the show that we can look at it positively is that we should be, this show should make us very, very grateful that we do have the 13th Amendment, that the North and the Constitution did win the war, that we are still united, and look at all the good that has come from that one moment in history, and you compare it to this one example of what could have been. And so I think these shows help us think. I think they're doing a bad job at emphasizing the negatives, or like the worst possible, instead of showing like the best possible or what we should be grateful for, instead of feeding the social warriors about things that never really happened, because this never happened, but it's fueling is making people feel unjust about things that didn't happen. If
right.
That makes sense.
Right. So yeah, and that's, I suppose the creators of the show would take the stance of, well, we're trying to show how it could be, you know, and they take that. But I imagine a lot of viewers don't take that. The lesson they probably take is, again, just feeding that sort of divisive machine, you know, one race against another, one class against another, all that stuff that's being stirred up in the U.S. So I don't know what their intention is other than to make money, obviously. but that's a pretty volatile topic to even make a program about, particularly at this time. So probably unwise for them.
Yeah, I think it's just causing a lot of controversy when they could have taken a more neutral path. And I mean, I think too, a lot of people don't like it because the South, the Southern states do have a lot of pride, and there are a lot of good things about Southern culture. It's not all negative, and it's not all about slavery. That, of course, is something that we don't agree with. But, I mean, you don't have to portray them all as criminals, and that's basically what this is doing. And so, I don't know, I think that it just, it's more of a feeding the social progressive propaganda machine rather than being an honest appraisal of what could have happened. And, I don't know, doing justice to the Southern way of life, because there is a lot of pride, like I mentioned. And I mean, I'm sure there are many noble things that happened during the war. The Confederacy did well, or that they should be proud of. But at the same time, you have to counterbalance that with, well, what was the war about? And it's good that the North won. So it's interesting to think about, but you don't want to defame a whole part of the country and libel them, basically, and their future generations with something that didn't happen. To me, just an unwise thing to do.
And it's also running opposite to the trend of never seeing black or white in any situation, but there's always a gray area. There's no absolute truth. Yet whenever people look at the Civil War, they have, after the fact, just totally maligned the Confederacy, like every single thing is bad about them, and that every person who lived there was a monster of some sort. In a lot of ways, and we've talked about this before, they were more family-focused, and they were more agrarian-based, which is, in a lot of cases, a more wholesome way of, you know, raising your economy. So there were some good things about them, but obviously they had that crippling sin of slavery that went along with the fact that they based their economy on agriculture. A lot of people in the North, that people forget this, they were just as racist, if not worse, but they didn't need as many slaves to stabilize themselves in terms of their jobs.
Yeah, it's interesting. Well, anytime they make these shows, whether they're historical or alt history or whatever, they tend to the seedy side of life. Like, they don't look at... They could have taken a lot of historical things and made a positive show from some time period, but that's not as exciting, is it?
Yeah.
they're appealing to the lowest common denominator, which is violence and brutality and et cetera, et cetera. Well, anyway, it is in the news, and an interesting time for them to be making a program like that. Here's a story that is interesting. People a lot of loyalty to a certain type of exercise program. So it's an opinion. It's opinion-based here. Just to write it from the Telegraph, there's this trainer who's talking about the HIIT fitness trend, I guess, the fad, as they call it, which is the high-intensity interval training. I think you've all heard of that in some fashion, where you, you know, instead of taking a gingerly bike ride for an hour, you sprint, you know, and have intervals and things like that. And this guy says, the issue is simply that people, he's not a big fan of this HIIT type of workout. And he says the issue is simply that people are doing workouts that they're not conditioned for. He says there's no emphasis on flexibility, mobility, or activation in many HIIT classes. So I think his issue is that people sign up for a class, they're not really ready for it, and all of a sudden it's like sprint to the wall and back. he says yet all of those are incredibly important in keeping your body fit and healthy as you age, flexibility, mobility, so on and so forth. Obviously there'd be people that do kind of get it all, and they do it. But a lot of people may not. And so that's what he's pointing out. He says, again, that they're not conditioned for it. I think we all see that at times where it's the middle of the day, you know, like on a Sunday, and it's 105 degrees outside. And you're driving down the road in town, and you see somebody running. And you can tell they haven't run in a long, long time based upon several key factors. And, you know, on one hand, it's like, well, great, good. But on the other hand, I think, wow, is that the best thing to do right now? Like maybe a walk would be good first or something. I think there's just humans, I don't know, I guess we tend to want to hit something like 100 miles an hour. But sometimes we're not ready for that, you know, like some of this training. He says, what's more, I regularly see people, quote-unquote, smashing multiple HIIT classes a day. I guess that means doing them.
Doing them hard.
Doing them hard. I'm smashing them. Hulk smashes, by the way. He says 5 to 6 days per week. He said those high-intensity workouts should not be done more than 3 times per week at the most. This is his opinion. Of course, he's a trainer. He says because it is so strenuous. It puts an incredible strain on your nervous system, joints, and muscles, especially if you are overweight and unfit. He says the approach, this high-intensity approach to exercise has gone out, in his opinion. He says it's entering unsustainable territory. He says the rise in popularity is symptomatic of what is wrong with the fitness industry as a whole, a brazen disregard of the fundamentals, and a detrimental one-size-fits-all mentality. He says, having trained hundreds of clients in my 5 years as a personal trainer, the biggest issues most people have are a lack of flexibility, mobility, and core strength, on top of muscle activation issues. All of the above can lead to chronic injuries and further exacerbate the problems that people have. So it's an opinion. I know some people really like those types. I'm not saying one thing or another about it. I think it's good probably within a bigger program of stretching and stuff. As I get older, my biggest issue is I'm not flexible. I need to stretch more.
Yeah, I think a lot of great points there because that's kind of a problem I have with the fitness industry too, my personal vendetta. I'm just kidding. But, well, because there's on YouTube especially, there's a million different people who think they're fitness gurus and they have their program, you can workouts you can do, and people follow them religiously. Whatever they do, I'm going to do. Whatever they wear, I'm going to wear. They want to look like them, have the same style and all that stuff. And most of it is just based on vanity. They want to have the big muscles. They want to be lean. They want to look a certain way. When they get there, those people have been doing that for 30 years. They get paid to do it. They have all the equipment. I mean, they're not Joe Schmo from the street going to their 24-hour fitness once a week. It's their lifestyle. And so it gives unrealistic expectations to a person who's just trying to exercise. And especially someone who's just starting their body, like the trainer says, it isn't ready. There's a lot of things you have to do before you can perform at a high level all the time. And a lot of it is flexibility, stretching, and easing your body into it. When you first work out, you can't be bench pressing 200 pounds. When I started working out, I just started with just the barbell, which is 45 pounds. I felt really embarrassed. I'm like, man, is this all I can do? I was just, I think it was 18 at the time. I'm like, man, this is embarrassing. But you build up from there. You have to start small and work yourself till you get bigger weights or longer times or more sprinting, whatever. And people don't have that mentality. They want to go big right away, and they end up hurting themselves.
Yeah, I think it's the drive for immediate dramatic results. And there's not a lot in life that happens that way unless it's bad.
Yeah.
You can immediately have your knee go out on you. I've had that happen. That's immediate and it's drastic.
I think there is also a mentality of, well, I really don't enjoy exercise of any kind. And so while I have actually taken the time to change and get my shoes on and step outside, I might as well make the time worthwhile and go really hard. And yet, like he says, if you're of a certain body type or fitness level, you might be hardly able to move for the next week. If you try to truly maximize that time, it could actually be detrimental.
Right. And then, of course, there's the fad of like, work out for 5 minutes a day, you know, like just spend 5 minutes, but go 1,000 miles an hour. And that's a recipe for disaster. If you're not doing a lot and then you hit it for 5 minutes really hard, that's a, you know, just imagine day-to-day life. If you were just sitting there, you know, watching a relaxing television show and somebody ran in with a, you know, one of those megaphones and screamed, "Sprint!" And, you know, you had a sprint for him. You'd be terrified. He'd kill you. You wouldn't know what's going on. I try to think about it sometimes in terms of working, literal physical work, because working out is just a substitute, I think, in a lot of cases for the fact that we don't work in some ways. If I had a day of work ahead of me, you know, 8 hours or whatever, and I was actually physically moving, if I had to move, you know, that pile from this spot to that spot of whatever, I think I would try to pace. I don't think I'd pick it up and like sprint. You know, people don't work that way. So it is just interesting. There's lots of things. I think his best point is that there's no one size fits all probably. Everybody's a little different. You know, if you're a bigger built guy, you're gonna be stronger. But if you're leaner, well, you're going to be a leaner guy. And you got to work with what you've got, obviously. But, too, I think a great point I've heard over the years is well, you should train for what you're doing. Like, if you, okay, I mean, if you're a professional athlete, you better be training because that's your job. If you're not, you probably don't, you know, I don't need to swim like Michael Phelps. Yes. I can't, for one, but two, why would I train that way? I'm not going to be a pro swimmer. So he does things that work for him, but I have a completely different lifestyle.
Yeah, and those more intense workouts, they do work, but it does have to be after a long time of doing it. It's not like we're saying that never do anything hard, but if you do something really hard and you're just an entry-level athlete of some kind or an aspiring athlete, it's not going to go well at all.
Well, and as you get older, and I found this, that even if I want to, sometimes I just, you know, I can't. Like, I pulled a muscle or something, and I got to let it rest. I got to stretch it out. I think the flexibility issue that he talked about is huge. Mm-hmm. If you're flexible, you don't get hurt as much. So anyway, there's lots of opinions out there about that and lots of ideas. And, you know, this is one trainer. Another trainer will say something else. But I think there was maybe some good points to think about. Speaking of exercising, we have a story about fried chicken. it's from the Business Insider. They tried the common fried chicken, and they rated them best to worst in their opinion. I was surprised by the results. They tried Church's, KFC, Popeyes, and Chick-fil-A. Any guesses as to the order based upon? I haven't eaten it. I've eaten at maybe two of those. There's some I haven't eaten at.
I'm going to have to, based on loyalty, I'm just on a limb, I'd say KFC first.
Yeah.
I'd say Church's, Chick-fil-A, Popeyes.
Wow. You almost got it completely wrong. They said this. Now, this is their opinion based upon what they said or what their experience was. They said the best was Popeyes, which I've never had. I don't know. I thought Popeyes just ate spinach.
Yeah, that's literally all I thought. Fried spinach.
What confused me. Number two is Church's. I've never tried that either. Three was Chick-fil-A. Chick-fil-A is very popular, but they only came in third. Last place, KFC. The Colonel has been demoted. Well, he's a private now.
That probably says a lot good about those other restaurants, though, because KFC is just delightful. I don't know how anyone could hate KFC. So all those other ones are probably just otherworldly.
I don't know. I've never been to Popeyes. I've never been to Church's.
I will say this isn't a chain, though, but the best fried chicken I've ever had in my life is at this little one restaurant place in Arkansas. Near Bentonville, where my friend lives. I was there for his mm-hmm. wedding, and we went there right before we left. And it's this place you go in, and you sit down. There's no menu. They just bring you, like, family size, like, mashed potatoes, corn, apple butter, biscuits.
You're just getting the works.
Wow. Yeah, and this huge thing of chicken. And you pay one flat rate for every one, but you just can't take food when you leave, but you just get as much food as you want.
Right.
And it's all homemade, and it's like home-style recipe, everything. It's the best fried chicken I've ever had. It tastes really good. And it's like, it's not that mass-produced. It's just really, really good. I forget the name of the restaurant, though, but it was excellent.
Well, right. You probably would find that the best restaurants or the best coffee houses are going to be the smaller mom-and-pop ones that they've really done. They've perfected what they do, but, you know. I don't know. Some people are more daring that way. I'm typically like, well, at least I know what I'm getting.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know what that place is, but I do know what Starbucks is. So at least I kind of know what's going to happen. That's the American mentality, I guess. Unless I got some time and I'm on like a vacation, then I don't mind kind of poking around. And it depends where you are, too. If you're in the middle of Oklahoma and they're like fresh seafood, you're like, wait, what now? the Kia David program's coming up here in a bit on KPCG. Also, the Trumpet Daily Radio Show, Richard Palmer today. Stop and check out thetrumpet.com. We should have called thetrumpet.com today Abraham Blondeau's blog. Canada's economy on the verge of collapse. Will Canada keep the monarchy? And Canada's housing bubble is stretched to the limit. Is it Canada Day today?
It should be. Yeah.
Did you write all those too?
No, I only wrote one of them.
He wrote one of them. Yeah. He ghost wrote the other ones. No. That's all at thetrumpet.com. Make sure you stop and check that out. Grant, you've got a write up here from Breitbart. An exclusive chief Alaska mosque preacher following removal of metal detector says, "Hey, I think we'll get along with the Jews now." Oh, wait, no. He says, "The struggle isn't over."
Yes.
Surprising.
He was interviewed by Breitbart Jerusalem, their branch over there, and sure enough, he said that they were not stopping at merely forcing Israel to remove their metal detectors, which they actually did do on Tuesday. Israel caved in.
Right.
They no longer have the metal detectors there. They're considering high-tech cameras, although that it's going to be harder to spot on camera hidden weapons than it would be to just sense them with a metal detector. So it's a pretty big change for Israel and probably a bad change in terms of security.
Yeah. Unfortunately, those cameras will probably just capture the next terrorist attack.
Yeah.
So you can play it on the news.
Exactly.
I don't know how you'd stop too many people with that.
It just doesn't seem like a great idea at all, except for the fact that there were a lot of protests and clashes up there on the Temple Mount in the last week that Israel, I guess, probably got tired of dealing with, and so they got rid of the metal detectors. But what this guy said, this chief preacher at the Al-Aqsa Mosque, he used to be the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem as well. He said, the latest understandings with regards to the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the removal of the electric metal detectors is a step that smells like victory. We will continue to follow developments with the goal of ensuring that Israel won't make any new steps, and we will oppose any new steps.
Yeah, I mean, he's just kind of tenderfooting around the fact that they just want the Jews out of there.
Yes.
That's the goal for them. They preach it. That guy in California was preaching it on YouTube. That's the goal. And so all this stuff is sort of just playing the game until they can hopefully, in their thinking, they can hopefully just get the Jews out of there completely.
Exactly. And this next quote explains that perfectly. He says that we will continue to protect the Al-Aqsa Mosque. And here it is. We will remove the marks of Israeli aggression from the mosque and continue to monitor the moves of the Israelis. So as far as we're concerned, the struggle still isn't over. What exactly are the marks of Israeli aggression, except for the fact that maybe there's some Jews up there?
Yeah, the fact that they're alive. Yeah. That's the aggression.
Well, and there's the whole city of Jerusalem are marks against the Jews, aggression against the Jews. The mosque is there because of the Crusades. The Muslims fought with the Romans and the Christians against everyone else and against the Jews themselves. So, I mean, the fact that those mosques even exist there is because of conquest. They weren't built out of some peaceful resolution or of goodwill or anything like that. They were built because they conquered that city. So I'm not saying that people today think the same way, but I'm saying that most of Jerusalem are marks of aggression against the Jews. It's not the other way around. Most of the ruins in that city are stained with the blood of thousands of Jews who have died there. For what they believe over thousands of years.
And if we applied the same standards to all people, now that the Jews are in charge and not the Muslims conquering the city, why can't the Jews do the same thing and decide for themselves what buildings remain, what don't, what types of security measures they're able to take in their own nation, what types of people they will bar from going to certain locations? Every time the people in charge of their own nation, the Jews, supposedly they're in charge of their own nation, they get criticized by the entire world for doing anything deemed in their own best interest.
Well, you know, Palestinians have played the Israel's weakness very well for years. You know, peace concessions, land for peace. You know, if you don't take those metal detectors down, we're going to riot. There's other ways to stop riots. But they're trying to appease, and that's the hand they keep playing. Make them appease us and appease us and appease us until we can destroy them. And that's not a recipe for victory in any way, if not for the Jews.
Right, and yet they keep on doing it. A lot of it seems like the Jews are just desperate for the approval of outsiders, and maybe that is just the natural human pull, is to want to be liked and to want to have their actions looked kindly upon by other people. But in this situation, that's just not the right mindset to have. They're in a war. The other side knows it. And yet, in a lot of cases, at least with many of the Jews, they don't even realize that they're in a war. They don't understand that there is an enemy within their gates that wants to kill all of them.
Well, and to me, the most frustrating part of all the whole thing with the metal detectors is that almost every other holy site in the Muslim world has metal detectors. Mecca does. Everywhere else in any Arab country, they have metal detectors before you can go into a holy site. But only in Israel is it an issue. every other place, they happily go through the metal detector.
Yeah.
But when it comes to the Temple Mount, they're willing to fight a war over it. To me, that's just, well, it's hypocrisy, and it's a fabricated grievance against Israel.
Sure. They're just looking for things to, excuses, and it really gets back to what Key of David presenter Gerald Fleury said years ago on a Key of David program, probably almost 20 years ago. He had a quote from one of the Israeli officials that said, "We're tired of fighting." And that is probably the overall sentiment. No, they do have some courage, certainly, I think, with their leadership, but the people in general, and probably just the overall mood, is they're just tired of fighting this battle. And so it's easier to capitulate than to fight and win. I mean, I don't know that it's easier, but I mean, it's the path of least resistance, I guess. But that path ends with you being not the power in that nation anymore.
Does anyone ever really ponder that? They're tired of winning decisively every time someone tests them. How is that possible? How could you be upset with the fact that you destroy your enemy every single time he even tests you at all? There obviously are sacrifices made in those situations, but the alternative is so much worse. You can't just expect to have peace with an entire region of people who hate you. They don't consider the Jews as friendly neighbors. They just want them out of there. They want to push them into the Mediterranean Sea, as they themselves have said many times. So either you win decisively in battle, or you get wiped off the map.
Well, that's like the crazy thinking about a lot of foreign policy today. It seems like nations, Western nations in particular, think there's some sort of odd third way. Like, they don't see it as win or lose. They see it as, well, we could maybe negotiate and we'll come to some peaceful settlement.
Yeah, coexist and blend society somehow.
Like as if, you know, and Churchill could see that clearly, that you have to fight the Nazis and Hitler and destroy them, or we're going to die fighting in our own country. There's no third way. You can be conquered and become slaves, or you fight. You win or lose. There isn't any third way, and we tend to, I guess, at least as far as foreign policy goes, from the U.S., from Britain, even from Israel, think that there's some sort of a third way, that we could just get along. If we just reconcile our misunderstandings, we'll live peacefully. When the entire history of man says that's never happened, ever.
It just comes from the false idea that human nature is fundamentally good. When you try to see the best in your enemies and think, well, deep down, they're all just fathers and mothers with children, and they just want to live peacefully alongside us. Well, they might be nice within their own families. A lot of the Nazi Gestapo were as well, but they were not so nice to the Jews in those labor camps, were they? It doesn't matter if they have nice families and they just want a nice life for themselves. It doesn't mean they want that same nice life for the people they've always hated.
Yeah. It's quite a deal over there. That's from Breitbart. And, of course, there's a lot on Watch Jerusalem. Brett Nachtigall's over there in Jerusalem. And he'll have a lot about this topic he has had in a few past shows as well. So make sure you listen for that. That comes up on Sundays. There's always a new one, or typically a new one, there at Watch Jerusalem. Abraham, you've got a write-up here, a scientific note from CBC. Scientists consider ways to dim sunlight, suck up carbon dioxide to cool the planet. And they're trying to cool us down. It's been cold in some places. I wouldn't mind if it was a little cooler here, but I don't know. How are they going to do this?
Yeah, I will put in this opinion at the beginning. I think some of these are the worst ideas ever thought of ever. And I'm not, that's not hyperbole. That's what I
truly
believe.
Not even just contained to science either.
Yeah, just in general.
They should name their conferences Worst Ideas Ever.
Yeah. It's even worse than that 17th Chevy Chase movie. but this is, they have some ideas here. And the first, there's two sections here. The first one is they're trying to suck up carbon dioxide from the air and store it underground so that the carbon dioxide in the air doesn't go up and heat up the atmosphere. And so what they're doing here, they have $23 million and they're basically building these giant fans. It will suck in the air, and then these filters will filter out the carbon dioxide and will go, then the air will go back into the atmosphere. And it's called direct air capture. And it's being supported by tens of millions of dollars from government sources, Bill Gates, the European Space Agency, they're all funding this effort. And basically what they're going to do is take the air out, but it's really expensive. It costs about $600 U.S. to extract a ton of carbon dioxide from the air. So $600 a ton. By the end of 2017, they want this power plant or this air-sucking plant to have a capacity of 900 tons a year. And that's equivalent to about the emissions of 45 people. So,
are you serious?
So if you do 600 times 900, that's how much, $600 times 900, that's how much money it will cost for this plant to function, and will only account for the emissions of 45 people. So in other words, it's very, very expensive. I mean, that's almost $600 million. I mean, that's almost $1 billion a year. And it's just a drop in the bucket for what they consider to be carbon dioxide emissions. So very expensive.
What do the fans run on?
Electricity from coal power plants, probably. but that's the thing. And then the carbon dioxide they take, they're trying to turn into green fuel that they can sell to or sell to greenhouses for fertilizer and that type of thing. So it just, to me, it's a very bizarre idea. It's very ineffective, very expensive.
Yeah.
And the funny thing is that carbon dioxide is part of our atmospheric air. We don't breathe in pure oxygen. We breathe in a very large mixture of different compounds. And carbon dioxide is 0.4% of what we breathe in. So it's part of our natural atmosphere. And so to me, this is kind of toying around with what's already there. And I'm sure there's a lot of carbon dioxide in the air, but that's why we have plants. Plants are natural ways of taking carbon dioxide out of the air.
Yeah, just if they're going to spend the money, plant some more trees. Or, you know, I don't know, not that they could do this, but if people just spread out a little bit and quit concentrating into these mega cities, that probably would help.
Yeah.
But, you know, how are you going to do that, right? I mean, I understand that, but still, this isn't feasible on any level.
Yeah, well, it would make us broke before we'd ever even making an impact on climate change in any way.
And it's one of those things where they're making so many decisions based upon something that's not been proven. I know the late night talk show hosts laugh at people that say that, but what makes them an expert? They're a comedian. I mean, great. Don't laugh so much. It wouldn't be so much carbon dioxide. But there's plenty of reports that show that it's not as big of a deal. This climate change isn't what people think it is.
Well, yeah.
Wouldn't you want to just stop and look at all that first? I guess you would if you were actually trying to come to an answer, but I don't think that's the case, obviously. I think it's obviously a lot of it's politically motivated.
Well, we all learn about the value of trees when we're little kids in school, and it seems like all these people totally skip that. They don't realize what the trees and the natural life is for. 45 people, they're trying to cover up the emissions for those 45 people, and yet it's that outrageously expensive. Once again, it doesn't seem like the cost is anywhere near the benefit that they provide. So it's almost like, are they just keeping the money for themselves? Are they just getting rich off of tricking people into believing that this is a huge crisis?
Something's going on because, and there's a lot on thetrumpet.com about it that you can look at, but you know, the past administration in the U.S., they talked about all this green energy, and that was a big thing. And it's a nice talking point during a campaign, but the numbers just don't add up, and that's the problem. And there's plenty of stories that where they built these plants and they hired these people and they were going to do all these things and they had no work and nothing worked. And the people sat there. They were paid with government money, I think, for the most part, taxpayer money, to sit there. They literally had nothing to do. I think in the case I'm thinking of, they were trying to make like car batteries for electric cars. Well, there wasn't enough cars for the batteries. And the batteries aren't good. What do you do with them when they're done? That's a landfill nightmare. So it's not like it solves anything, really. But they paid all this money, and people collected money, and they built the thing. And I don't even know what they do with that. I think they probably closed it down. But no one talks about that. They say, wow, green energy. Yeah, but take a look at these things that just haven't worked out.
Yeah, and we've probably never seen a bigger advocate for climate change who was a national leader than Barack Obama. He was all about that. He still thinks that's the biggest threat to human life. And yet he's done with the presidency and has like $60 million. That's not what the presidency pays. So you just, all these people, they tend to have so much money. And it's like, where did that all come from? Unless you were in on some pretty big scam like this, fooling people into thinking that the nation or the world is about to explode because of climate change.
Well, I think it's a great ploy to have an enemy that is, you can't determine if you've won or lost, or, you know, they're not fighting you. They ignore North Korea, Iran. The real threat's Russia, to a large extent, the Palestinians, you know, in the Middle East. And but we're going to fight climate change. It's nothing. You might as well go out in the woods and wave your arms around.
Childish leadership. I mean, it's prophesied too.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just a sign of how misdirected our policies are and how much money's wasted when it could go to a lot of really needed things. And just here's the second set of ideas they have, and these are even worse.
That can't be possible.
It's called geoengineering, and basically what you do is these are two ideas. You create artificial clouds that either reflect sunlight back into space or cool down the entire Earth.
Doesn't China do that? Don't they emit all kinds of clouds?
Yes. Yeah. from their coal power plants. Yeah. And then, or you dump tons and tons and tons of iron into the oceans to soak up carbon dioxide so that doesn't, so they don't heat up and all this stuff, so it doesn't impact climate change. So they have all these ideas. Basically, they're going to completely ruin every single environment on the face of the earth because they think they're saving it. And so a lot of, even on this, a lot of scientists say that's crazy. They say that it's going to cause, basically you're going to pump the air with chemicals that we don't know if they'll affect life, like us if we breathe them in, and animals. They're going to affect global weather patterns because the heat's not going to be there to have ocean currents, to have the winds that are needed to have like rain and all those sorts of things. It's just the worst idea you can possibly think of, throwing chemicals in the air to create artificial clouds, or throwing iron and stuff into the ocean, which I think iron rusts the last time I checked when it's in water. These are the ideas, though, and they're getting millions and millions of dollars to research this kind of thing from the government and from different people. And it's just, to me, it's just madness to think that these are becoming more feasible ways of fighting climate change when the solutions we're proposing are actually the ways we're going to destroy mankind.
We all come up with wacky ideas when we brainstorm, but the scary part about this is they're actually putting the money behind it and putting these things into action. I mean, that does no one see a problem with possibly contaminating the entire Earth's water supply by dumping all of that iron into it?
Oh, man. It's really strange, really, really strange. There's not a thing that man has touched that hasn't gone bad, typically. But the one big issue is that they're coming at it, the scientists, from the assumption that they know how everything works, or they know enough, and they can mess with it. The counterpoint to that would be, maybe you don't understand everything about the environment, and maybe you should just back up a little bit and take a minute. Because they know enough to be dangerous, to do some really dangerous things, but they're assuming that they understand how it all works. I'm just sure there's just a multitude of things that they just don't even understand yet. And so the idea of just some of these ideas, I mean, you'd think, I don't know, I think it was a parody if it wasn't right. Actually something they're going to try to do. Would you? Oh yeah, it's bizarre. It almost makes me... It's hard to even talk. I mean, it's hard to think of something to say about it. It's just so ridiculous. Because they always talk about, well, you got to save the fish and the coral reefs and all that, which is sure, of course. But you're going to dump a bunch of iron in there? Surely that's going to have a bad result. And probably 100 bad results we don't even know about right now.
Yeah, it just seems like this is something you find the Onion. Like, this is what we're paying scientists millions of dollars a year to come up with. That's some kind of parody. But that's actually what we're doing. And now this isn't mainstream necessarily in the climate change world, but it comes up over and over again, and I think it just illustrates the fantasy world that a lot of people live in, and how we're willing to create ideas that really destroy creation, but we're not willing to face the more immediate threats to our own survival, like the China, nuclear war, all these other events that threaten the survival of our nations. And these other nations don't care about this stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, they could care less about the climate. They want world conquest. And until people wake up from the dream world they're in, we're going to keep pumping more money into this than the institutions actually protect us.
Yeah. It's amazing. The environment, you know, I think it's probably a lot more robust than people would think. Not that you should pollute it, but it's a pretty robust system. However, life is very fragile. Like, our existence as a society is extremely fragile. And I think they're making it out like, boy, the environment's on the edge of catastrophe when it's pretty robust. But our society now, that's actually on the verge of catastrophe. And yet people a lot of times don't tend to think that it is.
It's, I think climate change is the greatest distraction ever in world history, because it takes the blame away from human morality, to blame for a lot of the issues we have in our world. And instead, it puts the blame on something very physical. While I'm sure it is a problem, it's not the cause of our societal evils or even a physical hardship like the climate and different things. That does come back to human morality. And so it's just the greatest distraction and the greatest excuse for humans to live however they want. But we're going to fight climate change. That's the big crusade of the day.
Is it a bigger issue than the destruction of the family?
Yeah.
What has more of an impact? Even if you want to look at, say, pollution, you could even trace a lot of that back to the destruction of the family unit. You know, people moved off of a farm-type-based system, and now they're all living in cities and so on and so forth. And of course, and then farms are not run like they should be. But again, aren't there laws for all those things? Didn't God give ancient Israel laws for how you handle the land? I don't hear anybody talking about those when it comes to climate change. Well, that's ridiculous. We wouldn't want to talk about that, I guess. That would be their thought.
Yeah, well, I mean, the Bible has a lot to say about climate change, actually. But the problem is people won't listen to the Bible when thousands of years ago, I mean, Moses wrote about climate change,
right,
but people won't listen to that.
Well, I mean, and this is the reality. We're out of time, but this is what they're saying. Some people cases. Forget that Bible. Let's dump a bunch of iron into the ocean. That's all the time we have for today on Trumpet Radio Live. Thanks for joining us. And make sure this is for the Key of David program, the Trumpet Daily Radio Show on the way. For myself, Dwight Falk, Grant Turge, and Abraham Blondo, have a great rest of your day. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
You're listening to Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG.